Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth on Power of Attorney Radio. Power of Attorney Radio is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, Blueprint for Wealth, at www.blueprintforwealth.org, where you can receive updates on tax, estate planning, and business planning topics of interest. We have audio, video, and articles that summarize many of the topics that you might be interested in listening to, watching, or reading about. So I invite you to check into the blog and subscribe to the blog so you can get periodic updates as we post to the blog. Today, I have a special guest joining me. His name is Randy DeMalkey. Welcome, Randy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks very much for having me.
Randy is the founder and managing director of Liquid Capital Group. He's a seasoned technology and venture capital executive with over 20 years of experience in senior management, business development, and financial roles. And he has extensive experience in building and maintaining over $100 million of venture capital and private equity fund of funds for institutional, municipal, and individual investors. He's been running Liquid Capital Group since 2000, and he's been managing portfolios for top venture funds and superior emerging information technology companies, both for high net worth individuals and families, as well as institutional investors. He specializes in due diligence, investment selection, risk management, investor correspondence, investor reporting, accounting, and fund administration. And today, Randy and I are going to talk about proper due diligence when you, as an investor, the listener, are considering early stage investments. Randy, first of all, a little background on you. How did you acquire this expertise? Where did you start your career, and how did you morph into Liquid Capital?
Sure, that's a fair question, Wayne. So I've been doing venture capital for the past 14 years. I started in March 2000, 14 years ago, almost to the month, right as the market was cracking. So it was a great time to become an investor. Yeah, no, as they say, I mean, you know, better to learn when things are going down and ride the wave when things are going up.
Right.
Before that, I spent 12 years in the telecommunications industry. So I was fortunate enough to be part of three emerging high technology companies. One was called MCI, which many of your listeners have heard of. The second was called Windstar, which was also very well known at the time. And the third was called Neon Communications. And I saw all three of these companies just go through explosive growth. I started there, of course, when I got out of college as a very low-level person and worked my way up to be a senior executive by the time I left the industry in 2000. Mm-hmm. So what I saw there was how companies can succeed, how companies can be challenged in their growth, and how difficult it is for companies to compete against, you know, the 800-pound gorillas in their industry. And the reason I decided to get into venture capital as a career is because I wanted to play in many emerging high growth companies at the same time.
And not just telecommunications.
Yeah, well, so not just the telecom industry, and then not just in a serial fashion, kind of one after the other.
Okay.
I didn't want to be single threaded, as I'm sure many of your clients and listeners don't want to be. And so I said, well, how do I get into a whole portfolio of companies at one time? And I said, you know, if I'm working at one particular company, I'm probably not going to have the time mm-hmm. to do that in a proper way.
So many of the listeners to this podcast are asking this question. They're saying, why should I invest in an early stage private investment? What's in it for me? Isn't there a lot of risk associated with that?
Yeah, absolutely, Wayne. There's a ton of risk investing in early stage companies. And so the trick becomes, like with a lot of investments, real estate just as one, mm-hmm. Is to do your homework, right? To make sure that if you're going to make an investment, it's a quality investment. And, you know, hopefully you've looked at many, many investments so that you can compare the one you do against the tens or even hundreds of ones that you don't do.
Okay. So this excess return, what's it called? How do you refer to it? Excess return.
Excess return. I mean, you're trying to get a return that first and foremost is commensurate with the risk that you're taking, right?
Right.
And then ideally, it's even in excess of the return you should be getting for the risk you're taking. And that's how you differentiate yourself against your competitors in my case. And if you're just a individual investor, that's how you exceed the indexes that, you know, frankly are extremely accessible to anyone who wants them.
Now, I've heard you say that investing is really risk arbitrage. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean is that if all you're doing is buying a security that is priced equally according to the risk you're taking, you really haven't added any value,
okay,
right? I mean, you've gotten a slightly higher return, but yet you've taken slightly higher risk.
Right.
What I'm looking for is that excess return that you talked about. So I'm looking for an actual mispricing, where mm-hmm. based on my analysis, I can buy into a security which is really selling at a discount to the net present, you know, the risk-adjusted net present value of all the future potential. And then I really feel like I've done, you know, me and my investors a favor.
So, I mean, Warren Buffett does that with public companies and some private companies. I guess he made his original multi-millions investing in private companies. But why private investments as opposed to public companies where there's a lot more information available?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you as a private investor get to become a super sleuth. You get to put on your Sherlock Holmes hat and really dig into things that in the public markets, you know, in today's day and age with the fair disclosure regulations and things like that, you're in some cases prohibited from doing the kind of homework we do in the private world. And in some cases, it's just not possible. So, you know, I'm the kind of person who likes digging into things and asking the tough questions and many times asking them over and over again and comparing the answers. And I think to a large extent in the public markets, again, that's either not possible, you know, just not possible.
You've stated in some speeches that I've heard you give that illiquidity is routinely overly discounted. Meaning that, you know, when we do valuations or appraisers do valuations or investment bankers do evaluation, they attach a discount to the value of the company because the investment is in a private company and the stock or the securities cannot be traded. It's illiquid. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting point, Wayne. I'll start with kind of the corollary to the fact that illiquidity is overly discounted, and that's that liquidity is often overly coveted and paid for.
Mm-hmm.
So you have maybe 90 plus percent of your portfolio in relatively liquid investments. You can call your broker and maybe liquidate everything in 5 minutes or 3 days or even a couple weeks,
right?
And you're paying for that. If you look at your cash portfolio, you're getting less than 1% potentially on your cash. If you adjust that for inflation, you're getting negative percent, but you pay that because you want that liquidity. There's a perception that you need it. The reality is that you don't. If you ask people how much percent, what number percent of their wealth they've ever had to access in a day or 3 days in a week or even a year,
mm-hmm.
I would say almost no one's going to tell you that number is greater than 10%,
okay,
right? So
okay,
why is everyone's wealth locked up in these liquid investments where essentially, again, you're paying a premium for that liquidity, which you really don't need? So I look at the converse of that in the illiquid world and say, well, if I'm okay with some measure of illiquidity and I'm going to get paid to take on those illiquid investments, some kind of premium,
mm-hmm.
right? So first we talked about a risk-adjusted return, then we talked about excess return
right.
Over that risk-adjusted return. Now we're talking about an illiquidity premium where someone may be paying you 200 or 300 basis points, 2 or 3 percentage points every year just to hold those illiquid securities. I like that. I like that paradigm. And I have allocated a large portion, in my case, of my wealth to these illiquid securities because I think I can do the due diligence and I want this illiquidity premium, which again, going back to the arbitrage concept, I believe I am getting without really having to give anything up.
Do most of these companies require, does it really require a liquidity event to generate your return on investment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I want your listeners to be clear about that. There is really, you know, for the most part, only one way to get out of these private securities, and that is for either some company to buy all the securities or the public to buy all those securities through an IPO.
Right.
And, you know, there are sometimes other scenarios where you get your money back, but they're really not worth factoring in.
So tell me about the golden rules of investing.
Yeah.
What are your golden rules?
Yeah. Well, the first golden rule is those with the gold make the rules, right?
So he who has the money, or she who has the money,
So makes if you rules. And I mean this, in, you know, in the most reverent way, of course. But if you are the person who's going to take either your money, or in my case, as a fiduciary, take my client's money and put it in a particular company, obviously you want to be very nice and polite about things. But there is no question that is off limits, right? And if people are cagey or you don't believe that you're getting 100% of the truth when you ask people a certain question, you, as again the guy with the gold, you know, should feel free to walk away from that conversation as soon as you hear something that you don't like. Kind of second golden rule that I like to use is don't let emotions get in the way.
Okay.
I mean, I am really passionate about what I'm doing in terms of supporting entrepreneurship and technology and the whole investing paradigm. But when it comes time to making your actual decisions, I try to put all that, you know, passion and enthusiasm aside and really put on my, you know, R2-D2 hat and just try to look at it as some computer algorithm would look at the situation.
What about the next rule? If you're trying to make a profit, then it's about the money.
Yeah, again, you know, I don't want to overstate the importance of the money. But if you're going to put on that hat that says I'm a private investor or I'm a professional investor, then it's about the money. Then it's a misnomer to come in and spend, you know, half the meeting talking about how you're going to save the planet like that's the actual goal. I mean, that's the vehicle through which you are creating wealth for either, again, yourself or your clients. But these are financial vehicles. These are financial investments. And so what I'm saying here with this rule is, you know, don't get sidetracked and don't get talked into the fact either by yourself or by the companies that there's some other goal, and that maybe that you missed your numbers or that you didn't make as much money is somehow okay given a certain context.
So greed is good.
Greed is good. You know, I mean, they said greed is good in the Wall Street movie, I think for a fact, but essentially capitalism is good.
It
encourages
good,
very productive behavior for the most part.
Next golden rule, it's not about getting to yes, it's about getting to no. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. So what I mean is when you are looking at investments, you want to get to know as fast as possible, meaning you want to reject all the investments that don't meet your criteria as fast as you possibly can. And then what you're left with is probably some really high quality investments that you can do even more due diligence on and figure out which ones you're going to do. So it's really a three-step process.
Mm-hmm.
Get to know with most of the investments.
Push them
get
aside.
Get to maybe with some of the investments.
Put them on the table.
And then get to yes with a very small number of investments that is probably between 1 and 3% of the investments that I'm going to look at.
Wow. So for every 100 deals that come across your desk, you may only be interested in 1 to 3 of those deals.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, most professional investors in the private stock world should have a similar percentage. Now, of course, if you are someone who has a relationship with me and my firm, or you have a relationship with another investment advisor, you may only see the best of the best, right? Mm-hmm. You may only see the maybes, you may only see the yeses. So, you know, in my case at Liquid Capital, our clients do about 75% of the deals that I would show them because I'm showing them the yeses.
I got you.
Right?
And
that's the, you know, benefit of having someone who's essentially standing in the middle of this process.
We're talking with Randy Demalke, who is the founder of Liquid Capital Group and is really a professional investor specializing in due diligence for private equity investment deals. We're going to end this segment and we'll come back to the next segment where we'll talk about best practices and due diligence in private equity investment. I'm Wayne Zell. You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth on Power of Attorney Radio.